And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
We've all heard the stories of courage and bravery of dogs as they struggle through fires to rescue their human friends or search through the rubble of collapsed buildings following the devastation of an earthquake looking for trapped humans. What drives these animals to perform such daring feats, we may never really understand. Today, we explore in depth another kind of inexplicable compassion that animals, specifically dogs, seem to possess. The animals who help disabled people live near normal lives as we visit once again Dave Ball and his dog named Hawk when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
3 years ago, I had a special guest on the Wild Side News. His name was Dave Ball, and he had a new friend, a dog named Hawk. What made this story so very significant is that just months before, Dave had almost given up hope of having a reasonable life, because since his truck accident about 3 years prior, Dave was becoming more and more paralyzed. By the time I talked with Dave, he was bound to a wheelchair. But through a stroke of luck, he'd been asked to participate in a special program by Canine Companions, which matched trained young dogs with people who needed help due to injury, accidents, or incapacitance from whatever cause. When I talked with Dave, he had many amazing stories to tell, and he'd found a new hope in life. Well, that was then. And this is 3 years later. And in our second segment, we get an update on David Ball and his dog named Hawk. And coming up, we continue our series of weekly Earth Summits, which begin right now. Welcome to the weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and we continue to bring you the insights, ideas, and innovations that the planet needs right now to reconstruct the hope that underlies the foundation of a sustainable and peaceful world. But in order to get there, we must understand our place and our time. And as you know, many of the stories coming in right now suggest that we are in a phase of accelerating change. And not only we humans are having a hard time adapting, so too many of the wild creatures. We first welcome Greg Butcher, who is National Audubon's Director of Bird Conservation, who gives us one of the latest updates on how our native bird species are faring in our rush to the future. Greg?
We put together information from the Breeding Bird Survey, which is run in the month of June, and the Christmas Bird Counts, which are run near Christmas time in early winter, to look at the population trends for all the birds of North America over the last 40 years. And we were surprised to find that there are a number of very common birds that have been shown very severe declines over those last 40 years. At least 20 birds have lost over 50% of their population over that 40-year period. A study was just published this month, the month of June 2007, and we're getting publicity on it now. The number one declining bird in our study was the northern bobwhite, which is a quail, which is found in open grassland and shrubland habitats throughout the eastern United States. And we had a similar group of species that like grasslands and shrublands, very similar habitat requirements to the northern bobwhite. So we've seen declines in meadowlarks, in loggerhead shrikes, and in a number of sparrow species, including grasshopper sparrow. For these birds, the main issue we're concerned about is habitat loss. There's a variety of habitats that are having some problems where they're either disappearing completely or they're being fragmented by roads and power lines and things like that. And we've also found signs that some of these birds are suffering from global warming. We have several species that breed up in the open tundra and whose populations are declining. We put out this kind of an early warning, since these are common birds. They're not birds that we really expect to go extinct. And so we feel like we've put out the report in time where people can take corrective action. And that's really a major focus of the report, is giving people ideas on what they can do to reverse these declines and hopefully get some of these bird populations increasing again. We hope people will start working in their backyard, doing things to make your own yard more bird-friendly, especially planting vegetation, native vegetation, that's good for birds, and trying to find vegetation that kind of fits in with the neighborhood. So if you're near open fields, you know, planting tall grasses, if you're near shrublands, so planting that kind of stuff, or trying to recreate a woodland environment can all be really good for birds. Also, we have an important bird areas program in the United States, and we're looking for people to volunteer at their local important bird areas, whether it's a state park or a national wildlife refuge or some other habitat like that that's proven to be important for birds. There's a lot of ways we can band together with our neighbors and do good things at these areas that are very important for our birds. And then we also would like to see people get involved in public action, become a grassroots activist, help improve legislation at the local, state, or national level, whether it's better habitat protections or helping to improve the prospect for global warming, so that reducing greenhouse gases, taking these kinds of public actions, it'll really make a difference for all of us. We have a website. It's www.audubon.org, A-U-D-U-B-O-N. And right at the top right now, we have the report on the declining common birds. We also have a public policy section and a way, you know, for people to get involved in our public policy actions. So a really nice variety of bird information available on the Audubon website. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. I know this wake-up call has inspired me to consider working with my neighbors to establish a neighborhood bird sanctuary through backyard plantings and maintaining cover and nesting sites, and trying to reduce the number of pesticides we add to our yards each year. We can make a difference. Our regular contributor, Ben Lowe, has some personal thoughts about that. Ben?
I grew up listening to Peter, Paul, and Mary. I know it's not my generation, but my dad really likes them. One of my favorite songs they sing is called If I Had a Hammer. Perhaps you've heard it. The theme is easy to pick up. If I had a hammer, I'd hammer out justice, freedom, and love all day. If I had a bell, I'd ring it out all day. If I had a song, I'd sing it out all day. And it struck me once. That's what I've often sounded like. Well, if I had more money, I'd buy a hybrid car. If only I were in charge, I'd mandate campus-wide recycling. If only I understood global warming better, I'd do something. And the ifs go on and on. We need to move beyond the wishful if. The Peter, Paul, and Mary song ends by going, well, I do have a hammer, I do have a bell to ring, and I do have a song to sing. Amen. Let's worry less about what we don't have and pay more attention to what we do have and can do. I can take public transportation more often. I can recycle my bottles and paper. I can change my light bulbs to compact fluorescents. We can all do something. Now, what is the something that you can still do?
With a spirit like Ben's, we can change the world. If we incorporate these changes into our world, we will be rewarded in many ways. Ethologist and animal advocate Dr. Beckhoff provides his take on how we can maximize those benefits. Dr. Beckhoff?
One of the things we've talked about in the past is watching dogs at a dog park to figure out what they're doing and also to see whether they may have some moral sensibility. And so a lot of questions I get from people all the time is, well, how can I become a better observer? Well, one way you become a better observer is you just observe and you practice. You don't write anything down. You don't talk into a tape recorder. You don't film through a camera. You watch the animals. After you watch the animals, you then may be talking to a tape recorder, take notes by hand, take some video. But there's no substitute for detailed observation. There's no substitute for watching the animals in their world, whatever it may be, a dog park or a wildlife park, or maybe if you're fortunate to see them out in nature. One of the other things I always say to people is observation and attention are synonymous. And I'll say, well, when you're feeling down, what do you sometimes do? And, you know, innumerable people say, oh, I go for a walk. Or I feel down, but I heard a bird sing. Or I felt down and I just watched two dogs play. And so I say to them, open up, you know, open your senses, open your heart to these experiences, because really we are still very ancient in our hearts and our heads, our brains, in terms of evolution. I mean, we do amazing things, you know, and we do more and more amazing things over the years. But the minute I tell people that it's a function of mindfulness, it's a function of being mindfully attentive in the moment, it's amazing the transformations that you see. And they begin to appreciate why birdsong makes them feel good. They begin to appreciate why being out in nature feels good, why seeing trees feel good or birds singing in trees feel good. I think it just comes down to attention, mindfulness, and of course the result of that is that you put away all the stuff that's caused you stress. Sometimes when I'm just feeling a little over the hill and I just go, oh, I just have too much going on, or there's something going on in my life that I don't really like, those are the times when I ride my bike the most or take hikes. And it's almost counterintuitive, because I'll say I have so much to do, but I then need to make the time to rekindle. And it's meditative. You know, there's many forms of meditation, and mine is to relax, sometimes close my eyes. I can meditate when I'm driving. I can meditate on my bike. I can meditate on my couch. I can meditate in bed or on my porch. But one of the best places for me to meditate, if you will, or be attentive and really, really focus on what's happening is just outside.
I'll be talking again with Mark next week to hear of his latest efforts at expanding the dimensions of human awareness about animal awareness. The process of integrating with our living world can and should be an ongoing state of mind. Dr. Thomas Lovejoy is a preeminent spokesman for maintaining a panoramic integration with the wonder. Dr. Lovejoy.
I think biological diversity does all kinds of stuff for us. You know, it underpins us biologically, it performs ecosystem services, it provides sort of basic encyclopedia about living systems on Earth. But it's also, you know, it's just extraordinarily beautiful and wonderful. I think one of the most important things each and every person should do with some frequency is just stop for a minute and, in a sense, smell the roses of the diverse planet on which we live. Because, you know, anytime you really stop and look at a plant or an animal, how it's put together and how it works, it's enthralling. And to lose any of it is worse than the worst book burning one can imagine. It's a wonderful, beautiful, inspiring world, and we should treasure it.
Thank you, Dr. Lovejoy. The amazing thing about all of this is that people come to this challenge with everything it takes to do the right thing. It's just that some of us have grown a bit lazy or have forgotten how easy it is. And that's where our master change artist and environmental healer, Dr. Matthew Sleeth, brings his years as an MD and applies them now to a bit of preventative medicine for planet Earth. Dr. Sleeth.
Every year, the Ichthus Music Festival takes place in Wilmore, Kentucky. 20,000 attendees enjoy 3 days of camping and fellowship under the bright Kentucky skies. Up until now, the thousands of bottles and cans used by the concert goers have been thrown in the trash. A few weeks before this year's event, Andy Bacy, a dean at Asbury College, told me of his dream to recycle the mountain of beverage containers produced at the festival. I had a U.S. group called Christians in Conservation. My group committed to recycling at the festival, and along with our student chapter and students from Asbury, we made hurried plans to do so. It wasn't easy. Our state does not have a culture of recycling. On the first day of the concert, more than half of the bottles and cans were being thrown in the trash, despite our recycling bins, which were right next to the trash cans. The recycling volunteers from Asbury and Christians in Conservation began going through the trash, rescuing the recyclables from amongst ketchup, diapers, and half-eaten cotton candy. This act of love and service worked its transformation on the crowd. Soon, many were heard to say, "I can't believe you care enough to dig through the trash." At the end of 3 days, we recycled 78,000 bottles and realized 400 pounds of aluminum cans. This represents a fossil fuel savings of 1,500 gallons of gasoline. But more important was the change in the 20,000 attendees at the music concert. At the end, a majority of those people used the recycling bins. What changed their mind and behavior wasn't a slick ad campaign or guilt, but the loving example set by the volunteers.
Thank you, Matthew. It is such a welcome sign that people of all faiths are awakening to the gift of the life of the earth, as well as their spiritual life, and finding the truth of the mystery that binds it all together. As Matthew points out, real change often happens best when people take their own initiative to do the right thing. Our next guest offers a gentle symbol of change, which he's crafted from his rural home in Minnesota. Great ideas are often born in the cornfields and piney woods of the common mind. We welcome Fulton Hansen to the Weekly Earth Summit. Fulton?
Yeah. Hello. My name is Fulton Hansen. I live in Pine County, Minnesota. About 16 months ago, we came up with an idea as a family. We were concerned, as everybody is, about energy issues, and we saw the relationship between energy and a lot of the things that were confronting us as a country, as a global society. What we did, we took an orange slow-moving vehicle symbol, which you see on the back of tractors and wagons and buggies, and we greened that symbol, produced a very graphically perfect triangle similar to the orange symbol, and on the three sides we put drive, easy, conserve. Extremely simple message, and the idea was to put this on the back of a car as an educator. Put a pine tree in the center, which symbolized Pine County, and the family went out to let our neighbors know that we had this. And the idea was is that if we could slow people down just a little bit when they're driving, it might be just that baby step that we need to bring them in, make activists out of them, help them become participants, and they're going to save fossil fuels, and they're going to save a little money on gasoline, etc. So that's what we did. We started off, first printing was about 1,000 of magnets. Actually, we did car magnets at first until I realized that on the back of a lot of the newer cars, it was plastic, so that didn't work. We decided to go with stickers. I'm glad we made that switch because they cost less and we can distribute a lot more of them. So we undertook this as a nonprofit venture for a family to try to get the word out that this would be a good thing to do for the planet, be a good thing to do for people in the future, and be a good thing to do for our grandchildren. So just to give you an example, when I have an older car, as most people in Pine County do. Be a while before the Toyota Priuses get to our area, but what I do is I drive my 1994 large automobile. I won't even tell you what kind it is. It's almost embarrassing, but it's a big old car. And we get 31 miles to the gallon driving that vehicle at 55. If I drive that at 70 to 75, I'm looking at somewhere around 21. That made quite an impression on me and an impression on a lot of other people. We didn't realize actually how much you do save by just driving your vehicle in the sweet spot. The sweet spot is that area where you get maximum efficiency as your car goes down the road. And so we decided to put these in print, and we have over 15,000 around Minnesota and Wisconsin, and actually have been picked up by a couple of foreign countries. Mexico has produced 3,000 of these and distributed them in Spanish in central Mexico. Dial us up, greenslowmovingvehicles.com, and we will send them to you. You can order them right there, or just call me on the telephone. And my number is on the webpage, but I'll give it to you again. It's 320-384-9967. Simple, it's free, it's conservation, and it's effective. People really like this idea, and it gives them something to participate in. So anyhow, that's about all I've got for Minnesota right now. So if anybody has any questions, please call me. We'll be glad to get some out going into your area. Thank you.
Thank you, Fulton. The most amazing thing about the future is that it is our future, and we can change the world one mind at a time. And that is the message that our renowned Earth Watcher and researcher, Dr. Charles Kennel, so wisely shares. Dr. Kennel?
10 years ago, when I was at NASA and talking about these issues, some people, in a casual social context, came up to me and said, doesn't it bother you that people just don't believe you? And I said, yes, but I said that at that time that if we scientists are right, and I think we are, then events will occur, climate events will occur, and people will sign up one by one, and they will see. And I think in many parts now of the at least the advanced world, in Europe and increasingly in the U.S., people are beginning to see. This is the beginning of progress. But it also means that, to my way of thought, we should move on from advocacy, which is important, but it's not the only thing any longer, and we really should start discussing solutions. And I think people, those people that are turned off by the overwhelming nature and scope of the problem that is outlined by the people who necessarily use the scope of the problem as part of their advocacy, people who are turned off or feel there's nothing to be done, will be attracted more by a philosophy that says, we're starting to do something, there are solutions out there, we've got to try them, and we're going to. And those people will get interested when they see us getting practical about it.
Thank you, Dr. Kennel. Today's Weekly Earth Summit provides a pocketful of great and inspiring ideas by some of the world's greatest voices of the Earth. Now, go on out and share the bounty. This is Sidney Wildsmith inviting you to join us next week and every week for the Weekly Earth Summit. And talk about inspiring. Wait until you hear our feature story about Dave Ball and his canine companion, Hawk. That's coming up, along with our Nature News update, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
So just what can a dog do for a human? You've seen them on occasion, people with their canine companions, mostly walking with them at a mall or in the street. But that barely begins to explain what is possible when two of the world's most intelligent animals team up to work together. Coming up, the story of Dave Ball and his canine companion, Hawk, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. The debate about whether or not animals actually think is pretty much over, except in some of the more esoteric dungeons of science. But even within our mainstream of civilization, animals are generally treated as fun and sometimes useful accessories to our lives. And that belief remains because we have few examples of what animals are truly capable of doing. We often refer to their agility, their strength, and cunning, but we don't often talk about their forethought, insights, and ability to analyze and act appropriately. Today, following our Nature News update, we present the story of Dave Ball and Hawk. And for those who listen carefully, the opportunity to develop a new paradigm of human and animal relationships is available. With some animals, and specifically dogs, the integration of human qualities and intelligence can indeed become quite profound. That's coming up, but first, the news. Here's some good news, I guess. The U.S. has lost its unique status as the number one producer of greenhouse gases and hands over the title to who else? China. According to a Dutch government-funded study, China now exceeds overall production of greenhouse gases compared to the United States by 8%, fueled by double-digit economic growth. With few, if any, checks on the output of pollutants into the air, China is now faced with some dire environmental blowback. The news may induce China to address more aggressively the issues of greenhouse gases as they continue their massive industrialization and transformation to a massive consumerist society. Americans continue their fascination with the desert Southwest, as people continue their relocation to Arizona, Nevada, and Southern California. Projections indicate that the populations of Arizona and Nevada will double within the next 20 years. Trouble is, water in these regions is already at risk from years of drought, and with the specter of global warming heating things up even more, some are beginning to wonder, where is all the water going to come from to support these massive increases in population? Cities in the region are already beginning to enforce water rationing. Flagstaff has been forced to sign a long-term deal with a ranch 35 miles away to enrich their water supplies. But this ranch is located downhill from Flagstaff and so must be pumped up to meet the needs. At this time, no effective limits to growth are being proposed. However, some who are predicting Dust Bowl conditions by 2030 in the region would suggest that natural limits to growth may in fact be imposed. Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society are in the news again. Mostly known for their aggressive stand in defense of the defenseless whales, dolphins, and harp seals around the world, using techniques that some feel exceed the laws of the sea, Sea Shepherd this week assisted in a secret undercover sting operation that put at least some of those responsible for the illegal taking of 18,673 shark fins behind bars. Working closely with the Ecuadorian National Police, Sea Shepherd was able to assist in intercepting two hidden caches of shark fins being transported in passenger buses traveling between Guayaquil and Haquias. An Ecuadorian and three Peruvian nationals were arrested. The fins represent over 4,500 brutally murdered sharks. The street value of the fins is estimated at $140,000. And meanwhile, a few miles up the coast from where the Wild Side News is produced, four long-beaked dolphins were found dead along the beaches between Carlsbad and Oceanside, California, the result of bullet wounds that killed them. One other dolphin died from apparent lacerations on its pectoral fins. Such killings in this area are rare, according to a spokesman for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The last such reported incident dates back over 5 years. Anyone with information is encouraged to contact NOAA, where a $2,500 reward has been offered. The times are indeed a-changin'. The legendary Texas oil billionaire T. Boone Pickens seems to think the answers to our energy crisis are blowing in the wind. And so he is preparing to launch the development of the world's largest wind farm in a place known for its big winds and open spaces, and his home state, Texas. The $6 billion, 4,000-megawatt project is planned to begin construction in 2010 and would provide enough electricity to power 1 million homes. Now that's a sign of the times, if ever there was one, and a good one at that, to which I say, more power to you, Mr. Pickens. And that's the news. And a few reminders. I'm hearing from more and more of my listeners who are giving me leads to some great feature stories. If there is something happening in your backyard, forest, or seashore, contact me here by email at wildsidenews@cox.net. That's WILDSIDENEWS at COX.NET. You'll be glad you did. And now to our feature. There's so many amazing aspects to nature and the living beings on this planet, human and animal and even plants. The stories are rich. Some people miss out. They never really do find that deeper connection with animals, and some people go to the other extreme and really find an extraordinary relationship with animals. And we're going to have a fascinating show with an old friend of mine, Dave Ball. Welcome back to the Wild Side News.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Well, Dave, it was 3 years ago we had a talk about you and about your dog, Hawk. Why don't you tell us where we were at that point with you and Hawk?
Okay. Well, 3 years ago, you had got me just literally 3 months out of my training of getting placed with Hawk. And we were just getting to know each other and getting to settle into our routines. And I was realizing the differences he was making in my life and everything that he was doing for me.
Well, now, some people may not know why you would have to form this relationship. Why don't you give them a background on that?
Well, because I had an injury way back in 89. I'm paralyzed. Use a wheelchair. I had pretty much become a shut-in. I wasn't able to do a whole lot for myself. I had just gone through a divorce, you know, so I was living by myself. And I needed the help. I had a doctor refer me to service dog, and I had seen one at one of my local events and then followed up on that, and that place was CCI.
Then that's Canine Companions.
Right.
In Oceanside,
right.
California. And you were very lucky, because otherwise, what was it? Was it a 3 to 5 year waiting period at that time? I forget what it was.
Right. It was upwards of a 5 year waiting list. Something had happened and someone was not able to make a class about 3 years in, and I got called up since I live real close by, and I was able to go, and Hawk happened to be there in that particular class.
And that was a very lucky break for you.
Very lucky.
Yeah. Talk about Canine Companions.
They are an outstanding nonprofit organization. They've actually got offices all over the nation. The one I attended was the campus down at Oceanside. They provide dogs for the disabled. They have different classes, service dogs, which is what Hawk is. So they have skilled companions for mostly for children, people under 18. They have therapy dogs, and they have hearing dogs. And they don't charge anybody anything for these. They, like I say, they're totally nonprofit, work off donations. They don't charge the people like myself anything for these dogs. So it's just amazing.
Well, that's extraordinary, because there's so much involved in training these dogs, and then as well, training you.
Right. Well, there's 2 years of training the dogs, a year and a half to 2 years of training the dogs, and then 2 weeks of training us.
As it turns out, you spent, as you say, 2 weeks on site. You literally go to the location. They have bedrooms, and they feed you and take care of you.
Correct.
And so then at a certain point, there's this process of trying to figure out which is your dog.
Right. It's amazing how they make the matches. They go through your complete medical history, and of course they already know the dog's histories because they've been training them. And the trainers just have this knack for making these perfect matches. Obviously, like when I went to class, Hawk and I clicked from the very get-go, and everybody saw that, but that was the trainer's intentions, too. That's who they had pre-matched me with to start with. And this was before they really got to know me much more past my application process. This is just from what they did know of me from my one visit down there and what I put in my application. They were able to make that sort of a match right off the top. You know, 2 weeks out, you couldn't have told that we hadn't been together his entire life.
Well, when I talked with you, you were with Hawk at 3 months, and from my perspective, it was as if you were a new man. It was as if you had found something you desperately needed to help you in your situation and to move forward in your life. So let's take it from there, because that was 3 years ago. You bonded with Hawk. He's now been working with you. Tell us what's happened.
You're right. Before I got him, I was highly depressed. I didn't go out, didn't do anything, didn't feel like I could. Kind of felt outcast, felt unable and unsafe to do things. Got him, and life changed big time. You know, we had the interview with you. After that, him and I went back to college. I got certified with Microsoft Office. I'm actually working now as an advocate to help other disabled people get out, live independently, learn how to deal with their disabilities, and face the same trials and tribulations I was going through.
Well, you've come a long ways.
Yeah, and Hawk is there with me every day. He helps them, too.
How does Hawk help you get through your day? Tell us about what's involved with Hawk and you on a normal day.
Hawk spends his days right there next to my desk. They've allowed me to put up a little bed for him right next to my desk. If I drop things, papers, pens, whatever, he's there to get them for me. He goes out with me to visit with the clients when we do intakes for people with disabilities. He's there, and he has a calming effect on them. They're just amazed because I'll have him go through some of his basic commands with them to show the difference he can make in their lives. And it also calms them down, too, because a lot of them are where I was 3 years ago. They're dealing with the disability and trying to get back their independence, and they don't see it happening. And then they hear Hot's story, and I say it's Hot's story because he's the one that made all this happen. They're just amazed, and they leave our office with a whole new confidence. A lot of it's just his presence and his friendliness and his willingness to work.
You wake up in the morning. There's a lot of things you can do and a lot of things you can't do. You're fairly much confined to a wheelchair, I have to assume, still?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And how about the use of your arms? Give us a kind of an overview of what you can and can't do.
I do have use of the arms. I'm a lower-level paraplegic, so I do have use of the upper body. It is limited because of damage to my shoulders from pushing the wheelchair for those years before I got him to help pull me around. But then he can help dress and undress me.
How does he do that? How in the world does a dog help you dress and undress?
Well, undressing's easier, obviously.
Yeah, right.
I can just bend over at the waist, and he'll grab my shirt collar and take my shirt right off, or I can point to a soft and give him that command, and he'll take my socks off or pull my pant legs down for me. He can do it in reverse as well, and he can also retrieve the clothing items for me, my shoes, whatever, and bring them up to a level where I don't have to bend to get them. And he allows me to use his body as a support, too. Huh. When I'm, like, putting the socks on or something, I can rest my feet up on top of him for support at a comfortable angle.
Talk about some of the common things that he can help you out with, and then I'm sure that when you spend this much time with an animal like Hawk, where there is such a bonding, I would have to assume there's been some extraordinary things that you both have learned to accomplish together.
The common things are stuff like helping me with drinks, getting drinks out of the fridge, or helping me pick up items that I may drop, pulling my wheelchair. When I get tired, I grab his harness, he'll pull me around, opening, closing things.
Doors and things of that nature?
Yes, doors, mm-hmm. Cabinets, drawers. Even filing cabinets, if he can get his mouth on the handle, he can open it, and he just uses his muzzle to push it back closed for me.
That's amazing.
Extraordinary, most definitely. He has learned how to retrieve my wheelchair, because I was the world's worst about setting my brakes, and it would roll away. And that came in handy, because here, I would say probably about a year after I spoke with you, I was up at a local mall and had a run-in with a teenage guy that was trying to show off for some people he was with, and he decided he didn't like the fact that I had gotten the last handicap spot there, and he was attempting to use his parents' handicap pad for that same spot. And so he got mad and took my wheelchair about 15, 20 feet away from my van.
Well, there's words for him that I won't use right now.
Well, that's okay, because wow. Hot showed him just how ineffective that was. Hot, he had not seen Hot because Hot was in the back of the van. So I turned and I told Hot, and I said, chair. Hot jumped out of my van. He went over, got my wheelchair, and dragged it right back in the van for me. It turned out my Dodge showed him up in front of his friends instead of the other way around.
Well, no, I know that I've had dogs in the past, and I do know that they do have a protective instinct, too. Did you detect at all that he sensed that you were in danger from the aggression by this jerk?
Yeah, there was, but he doesn't show it. He is protective, but it's a passive aggressiveness. When he feels there's a threat, even if it's somebody coming in and raising their voice at me, he doesn't growl at them or show his teeth or anything. He just moves closer to me and, and places himself between myself and the perceived threat, and just gets to be his lovey self, you know, rest his head on my lap and look for some petting. And with his size, you know, 85 pounds of black lab mitts, that's enough of a deterrent right there. He doesn't have to show any aggression.
That's a good-sized dog.
Yes, very good size.
And looking at his photograph, he's changed a lot. He's a dog now. I mean, he used to be a cute puppy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a mature dog now. The thing I noticed about his face is that he seems to have a smile and yet a serious side. Is that kind of his nature?
Yes. He is. He's got a practical joke side to him, and he is always smiling, always. But he's always on duty, even when I tell him he's not. If he even senses I need something, a lot of times I wouldn't even have to give him the command, although I do to keep his training up. But he's always ready to do the work, but he's always very happy and always has that little toothy grin of his.
So at this point, to what degree is he now just really become integrated with your life, knowing what your needs are? What are the kinds of things that he senses that you need in advance?
It can be anything as simple as my moving towards the kitchen, and he knows I'm headed for the fridge to the point of sitting in the office and a piece of paper falls off my desk. He's there. And he knows through his training he's to wait for the command to pitch it up, but he's already there ready to pitch it up for me. It's like my wheelchair. You know, I can't see leaving the house without him now. He is such a huge part of my life and not one that I take for granted either. He's good at reminding me of things, too.
Well, what do you mean now?
Sometimes I'll go to leave the house and he's figured out that if something needs to go from here to the office, I place it in a certain area in my house, and or vice versa, coming from the office home. If I try to leave the house without that item, he doesn't leave the house.
Oh, that's great.
He will kind of hold back, and when I look at him and I'll ask him what, he goes back over to the pile and, you know, kind of stands there like, you're forgetting something here.
That's really beyond the call.
Yeah, very intuitive and very observant.
Wow. Now, also, I recall it was such a stunning story about how when you were actually going through your training, that you do, I don't know if you're still suffering from occasional kind of nighttime seizures, that he sensed that without any training or knowledge of this, and while you were having a seizure in your bed, he instinctively jumped up on the bed and almost held you in the bed. Is there still that type of dynamic that's alive between the two of you?
Oh, yes. What it was the pain level. Every time I rolled over or anything, it was enough to wake me up. And once I was awake, I'm awake, period, and couldn't get back to sleep. And what he had done was the very first night we spent together in the room, he had been up on the bed with me. We were supposed to put him in the crate for the night, but he cuddled up with me, and it was like 5 in the evening, and I fell asleep and didn't wake up till 8 the next morning. And he was still in the exact same position, had prevented me from rolling over during the night, so there was no cause for pain. And he does that to this day. And actually, he knows, I'll tell him it's bedtime, and he goes in there. He pulls back the covers, lets me get settled in, and once I'm settled in, he settles in right next to me and keeps me in one position the whole night through.
That's just astonishing. There are things that you're learning that I can't even know how to ask. So I'd like to have you just reach deeper. You know, sometimes we're a little afraid to talk about what we think is the truth. For example, you may sense that this dog and it really, really understands you. I mean, that there's a tremendous understanding, but I don't know. So what I'd like you to do is now help me and everybody listening understand how far this goes in terms of what you've learned about the capacity for an animal like Hawk to communicate and know you as a human.
That is a hard one. We're like one, is the best way to describe it. Where I leave off, he picks up, whether it's physical, mental, whatever it is. Like I said, I can't see leaving the house without him. He knows me and my routine and my needs so well now that he's always right there, and he makes the difference in my life. I seriously don't think that I could go through a day without him. Even when he is fit. He will try his best. And obviously, you know, he's had a couple times he's gotten sick, and obviously I still bet my activities because I want him to get his rest. He doesn't want to. He wants to work. He almost looks like he feels bad if he can't work. So many things in my life have become easier and become possible because of what he'll do for me, even just his being there. You know, even if if it's something, you know, he can't help me with, his being there is the support to go through with it and be able to get it done. And he's just as happy as if he did it himself. In a lot of ways, he may be 3 years older, but he's still a puppy, and in the way that anytime we achieve something, he celebrates just like a puppy. He will dance around and really have a big smile, tail going, you know, tail shaking the body instead of the other way around. We have a lot of fun. I can't think of one time of depression I've had since I've had him. You know, anytime things get rough, he's there just to keep me happy, if nothing else.
Well, that is the nature of dogs, it seems. They give and they love without holding back. I'm sure you've run across people who don't treat dogs well, and yet that dog will be so loyal, so loving, so forgiving, always there for them. I don't understand that because I don't know any human like that, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious what you think. What is it about dogs after this much time? What do you think drives them? What is their motivation to do this? You repeat this concept that he wants to work. Do you have any insight into what is his payoff?
I think his payoff is just the fact that I'm happy and he feels that. He doesn't feel any negativity from me whatsoever. Each and every day, even after 3 years, is a joy, and it's an accomplishment, and it's a sense of pride in you know, being able to do things. They always say emotions travel down the leash, and I believe that. I believe he feels nothing but joy and happiness and accomplishment, and that makes him feel good just like it makes me feel good. And I think that's what he strives for each and every day.
It's an absolutely amazing story, and I can sense in your voice that you're a very positive person. Something's healed a bit inside of you. You were, when we talked, a very positive guy, but I can just sense that there's a more sort of generic happiness and a contentment in your voice. Because you spent a lot of time with canine companions, I'm sure in that 3 years you as well have been exposed to a lot of people who are relying on the canine companions. What are some of the stories that have really caught your attention?
I think the one that stands out most in my mind is this. She was, I believe, 13 at the time. She went through the same class I did. She has cerebral palsy, and she got a skilled companion dog. She's the type of girl that was always had a smile on her face and tried, just never would give up, kept pushing and pushing, you know, to get through the day, even as no matter how tired she got and stuff. But therapy-wise, physically-wise, she was giving up on that. She was getting tired of people that don't know telling her, you know, what to do. It's kind of like they weren't in that position. How would they know? Well, she got this dog, and her life's changed completely. She's went from using a wheelchair with power assist technology, which helps it make it easier for her to push, to using just a regular wheelchair. She's been doing wonderful in school. She's been pushing herself to do more and more activity-wise. I haven't heard her say no or give up on anything. And when I go up and I see them and see this dog interacting with her, that smile is not even remotely forced. She's glowing all the time, and it's really touching because, to me, I felt she was kind of at that point where she could have gone either way, and the dog made a whole world of difference to her, and it gave her that extra little boost. It's that friend that's always there no matter what. I mean, I can well imagine at that age how hard it is to have friends and keep friends. This is a friend that's there all the time for her. They've dressed up at Halloween, the cutest little matching costumes. They've been camping. A whole new glow to her. She's pushed herself a whole lot harder, and I've seen a definite improvement in her.
Cerebral palsy is such a difficult reality. It's just so complex. Is she able to use her limbs to get around with the wheelchair?
She has to adapt to it, obviously. She pushes herself harder now than she did at the time she was down there. It was in a matter of months she went from using power assist to pushing just the straight wheelchair, regardless of where she went. I think her dog also gave her a sense of independence, too, because more and more she wanted to learn how to do the things she didn't know how to do. She was asking for the help to learn how to do transfers into vehicles or how to accomplish certain tasks with her limitations. Before, she wasn't all that interested in that, but she had that sense of independence now, and the girl went to prom. She had a date to the prom.
Oh, okay,
that pretty much wraps it up there.
What do you think is perhaps the most amazing thing that Canine Companion has been able to do?
They changed so many lives. There's an autistic kid that wasn't talking very much at all, if at all. I think my understanding was communicating with the parents, and that was it. He got a dog, and now he talks to everybody. He's a lot more outgoing. He's progressed by leaps and bounds. These dogs bring everybody out of their shells. I mean, it's all new people.
Well, you mentioned when we talked before that prior to Hawk, you were confined to a wheelchair. You were feeling pretty miserable about life in a lot of different ways. It's a sad commentary, but a lot of people are kind of frightened by people in wheelchairs. But then you got Hawk, and suddenly kind of the world began to open up because people were just, if nothing else, they felt a little more comfortable.
Yeah.
With the fact that there was this canine companion dog, and that opened up a whole new world for you.
Right. Yeah, I don't think it's so much as they're afraid. I think they just don't know how to deal with us. Awkward probably is a better statement.
That's better. That's true.
But most everybody out there loves dogs. And then when, you know, you've seen the picture yourself, when you have a dog walking around with a smile on your face, how can you resist? You have to, you want to talk to the people and find out more about the dog.
When people come up to you, what do they ask? What do they want to know about you and Hawk?
First thing they want to do is pet him.
That's inevitable, yeah.
Yes, that's the very first thing is pet him. And some of them will ask what he does for me. Others just want to know how long we've been together, and they comment on how good of a team we make, you know, how good we look together, doing whatever it is we're doing at the time, how much they admire him for whatever it is he is doing that they've seen. It opens the door, so the conversation can go further from there. You know, they feel a bit more comfortable about asking, well, what is your disability, or what can you do, what does he do for you? How should I handle this if I run across somebody in your situation that doesn't have the dog to help? He helps educate, too. He opens that door where people want to learn this stuff. And that's a big help, too, to the entire disabled community.
We're talking with David Ball, and is Hawk there? Can he say a few words?
Yeah, he's sitting here belly up with a grin on his face. Hey, Hawk, they want to hear you. Yeah, come on, speak. Come on. No, don't sneeze. Speak. Hawk, come on, wake up. Come on, Hawk. Come on. Give me a good speech. I want a good speech. 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 There's a good one.
That's
great. That's a good one.
Good. Tell Hawk thanks from Sydney.
Sydney says thank you.
He's a good boy.
He gives you a bell.
All right. Well, that's an honor.
Yes.
Well, now let's talk about the next level here, and that is the fact that there are a lot of people out there who could be in need of a canine companion. Give them some encouragement. Tell them what they need to do. Tell them where to go.
They need to go to www.cci.org. They can find out all the information they need about CCI right there, including what region they live in, what office will serve their region. They can get the contact information, so they can put in their application, which, by the way, from my understanding, the wait time now is way down. I don't have an exact figure, but there's been a much higher turnover rate with people getting paired up with these dogs.
That's great.
A lot of people are getting helped really quick now. You fill out your application, We paid $100 for supplies, but nothing for the dog.
Well, $100, that's a good meal at a restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. And most of the regions do have on-site places for you to stay if you live too far away to commute back and forth during training. They have dorms that are beautiful. I mean, our donor base is wonderful. So many private individuals making these donations to make these programs possible. Sometimes I wish I'd rather live down there.
Yeah. I visited at the Canine Companion facility here in the San Diego region, and there's kind of regional centers, and it is really very impressive, and some extraordinary people, everyone from just everybody, including the people who work with the dogs and work with training them with you. And it's a huge task. It's a huge task. There's also people who can participate by helping to kind of help raise some of the puppies.
Right. We have puppy raisers where they will take the puppies from the time they're 8 weeks old until they're anywhere from 1 to 2 years, depending on the dog, depending on the need at the time, and depending on how well the dog picks up the basic training that the puppy raisers would give them, which is like the sit, stay, those type of commands, and whether or not they show an interest in doing this work. Like I said during our first interview, if these dogs don't want to work, they won't make them work. Mm-hmm. They don't want unhappy dogs out there. And I've seen them let dogs out of our program just because they don't seem interested in doing the work. They're just trying, yeah, I'll do it, but I'll do it when I'm ready to, you know.
Yeah. There's also a fascinating aspect, the graduations. I hear that is a ceremony to behold.
Oh, definitely. If you watch that website, they will tell you when the graduations are in their area. You can also do it on their mailing list through the website. It's definitely something. I've never a dry eye in the house after that, because you get to hear wonderful stories about just the difference in those 2 weeks' time that the dogs are making in these people's lives, what they went through during training, what they experienced, their feelings. 2 weeks doesn't sound long, but it's tiring. It's emotionally grueling. They bring out a lot of things in you that you might have suppressed as your way to deal with life. You know, these emotions come rushing up, and it's just overwhelming. But it's a good overwhelming. And you always hear all this positive feedback from these ceremonies. It's well worth going to.
Well, I don't believe there is any more worthy organization out there than Canine Companions. First of all, the wonder of working with these extraordinary animals, selecting them, training them, and then bringing them to service for people in every form of need. It is one of the most direct and meaningful organizations out there. Why don't you go ahead and again repeat how people can help, and they can donate time, money, and goodwill of all sorts. Yeah,
exactly. All the volunteer opportunities are listed at the website www.cci.org. There's volunteers pages that tells people all the different ways, and there are a lot of different ways. Those people that volunteer, I can't say enough about them. Every single one of them is just really awesome. Just like the staff are at these campuses, it's like one huge family, and everybody welcomes everybody, and every little thing that's done is very much appreciated, and in some way is going to positively affect someone with a disability's life, like myself.
Yeah, directly. Absolutely directly. And for a long term, in many cases, much of a person's life.
Yeah, we're looking, I'm looking at it probably about a 10 to 12 year working life with Hawk.
Wow.
And that's a huge, huge chunk of life, and that's a huge difference in my life. And then when it comes time for his retirement, CCI is going to be right there to help with that and help transition and help set me up for a successor dog, too.
We're going to carry on this conversation over the years ahead.
Okay.
And now let's get on to something important. It's closing in on supper time here. How's Hawk going to help you make supper?
Well, he's already had his supper, so he's going to help me choose some meat out of the freezer, and we're going to take it from there. He did to help me empty out the dishwasher today and help open and close some cabinets in there and whatever else I can think up for him tonight.
Well, give Hawk a special pat on the head for me. And David Ball, thanks so much. I always enjoy talking with you. You're a great soul on the planet.
Thank you. We sure appreciate everything you do for us as well.
Thanks a lot, David.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us here on today's Wild Side News. And get prepared for the longest day on Earth, coming up in your neighborhood very soon. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet next Thursday, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.